What do I have now? Mavericks? No, before Mavericks. Whatever the one before that was.
Yosemite. I don't know which one you're on, but
well, no,
there's
but,
too many Apple things. It's every no, year I know, they break something. Ah!
Building websites in my sleep, counting content types instead of counting sheep.
Hello and welcome to Drupal Easy Podcast number 143, recorded today, Monday, January 19th, 2015. I'll be your host for today, Ryan Price. Sitting with me in the frozen north, I'm sure, near a gorge, is Ted Bowman.
Thank you. Yep, it's pretty frozen. It's actually thawed out a bit. I went ice skating on Saturday, though. It was awesome.
Yeah, we can't do that down here. We no. could go water skiing, I guess.
Well, you guys, what do you guys have, like three hockey teams in Florida?
Yeah, I don't know what they do. How do the kids learn to ice skate in the first place?
No, it's probably Northerners coming down.
Could be. I mean, we're now getting... So, okay, tangent. Okay, I could start a tangent, or we could just get on with the intros. Mike and Nello, you are here as well.
Yeah, I hate those Northerners who moved down to Florida. Those guys are the worst.
Are you playing on one of those teams, Mike?
I'm sorry?
Are you playing on one of those teams? Pro hockey teams? No.
No. I don't think my name is nearly French or European enough.
Yeah.
Or just rough enough. I mean, those are some tough dudes.
On the other hand, though, Mike,
although Patrick Waugh, that's not a very tough name.
Never mind. I was going to bring up the fact that Mike climbed a mountain last week, but forget it. We're moving on.
Moving on.
Mike, we have a little bit of a different show today. You actually have kind of like done some time management, which you're very good at, and you have pre-recorded the interview for today's podcast. So go ahead and tell us who we've got coming on the show, and then we'll ask you some questions about it.
Yeah, so I actually talked with Stefan Torlasquette, was it last week? Last week, early one morning. It was actually kind of funny. It was the first like early morning podcast that we did. But I basically interviewed him and Sachini Herat and Kevin O'Leary, who's in the office of the CTO here at Acquia, and Kay Van Valkenburg from Own Sourcing, who's been on the podcast before. They were all involved in the schema.org integration into Drupal 8. Sachini in particular was their Google Summer of Code student. She's from Sri Lanka. So, hey, how's it going, Fozzie? What's happening? Was that Fozzie or that was another animal?
That's the dogs, Emmett and Waffles. I'm going to mute if I can.
That's right. Fozzie is a cat. That would be weird if it was Fozzie. Anyway, I talked to them about the schema.org integration D8, which, you know, honestly, I didn't expect it to be nearly as interesting as it ended up being once I actually started researching the topic. They're doing some really, really cool things. Not only as far as what's gotten in core already, but with a companion contrib module that Sachini has been working very, very diligently on. And just a spoiler alert, it's actually going to give you the ability to choose a schema from schema.org and the module automatically create a content type on your site for you that maps to that schema.
For the win.
Yeah, that's huge. So that's really, really interesting stuff. And I guess let's go ahead and roll the interview. Alrighty, so I am here with a bunch of people who are involved in the schema.org integration in Drupal 8. Joining me, literally right next to me, is Stefan Koloske. Did I say it correctly?
Yeah, Koloske.
Koloske, so the T is a little bit harder than, okay. I was trying to like really, you know, make it very European instead of slightly European. Chris Wells, Kay Van Valkenburg, Sachini Herat. Did I say that right, Sachini?
It's Herat. Yes, it's that's correct.
Okay, very good. And Kevin O'Leary. So it's a little bit of a big panel, and I'll do a little bit more deeper introductions as we go. But I guess let's start with you, Stefan. We've talked to you in the past about RDF and RDFA integration in Drupal 7. And what we're talking about today is kind of that same thing, but now in Drupal 8. So just as a reminder for everybody, or get everybody back up to speed, what are we talking about here when we're talking about RDF and RDFA integration? What does that actually mean for people? What does that bring to the table?
Okay, so RDF is this standard that lets you describe your data. So it's about saying that a web page or a piece of data describes something, like an event or a book or a person or a recipe. And then within that entity or within that page, you have different values, like the title of a blog post, the date it was posted. For an event, it's a starting date. For a recipe, it could be a list of ingredients. So you have all these values, all these properties, and with RDF at a very high level, you can say what a string is, if it's a title or if it's the name of the author of a blog post. RDFA is taking RDF, which is fairly abstract, and bringing it into HTML. So you need a vehicle to transfer your data from, like, say, a server to your browser. So HTML is one way. JSON is another popular way of doing it. And again, there's a way to also embed RDF in JSON. So in Drupal 7, if you look at the source HTML, you will probably notice quite a few lines of namespaces at the top. There's FOF, there's Dublin Core, there's SHOC, S-I-O-C. So those are all namespaces that we used in Drupal 7. And we realized that people were confused about all those numerous namespaces. And so when you were building your site, you had to pick types and properties from all those namespaces, and it wasn't very easy or intuitive. So what the search engines did is they got together for once, and they stopped competing basically for a little while, just because they realized that they had a lot of benefits in getting together and standardizing all this.
They were all going after the same thing.
Right, which is like your data, or like understanding how the data is structured on the web. So they got together and they started to aggregate or collect all those useful types from different places and put them into one central namespace called schema.org. And they added quite a lot of types as well, just the types that are very popular and useful for webmasters. And also this was driven by what kind of queries people ran on Google. What kind of things people are interested in, like events. There wasn't, for example, a very good event namespace before schema.org. So that means when you compare the HTML markup of Drupal 7 with Drupal 8, you'll see a big difference. You only need to use schema.org, at least to begin with, as a foundation. You no longer have to get all those different namespaces together like you did in Drupal 7.
So the way it was described to me a long time ago, I don't know if it was you or someone else, but it was described to me as food for robots.
So that's still correct. That's exactly what it is. It's for machines. It's not really for us. For us,
we don't see it. The visible web page doesn't change
absolutely
for us.
And we don't actually need to see it most of the time, because we can quickly, with our eyes, break down the page in different elements. So we can tell if it's an event or a recipe, because we'll have a picture.
We have visual context.
Exactly. Right. Machines don't have that context, so you need to help them to understand and not to get your data wrong. Google and all the search engines, they'll try to understand what the page is describing. If you don't give them any hint, they might get it wrong. With RDFA and schema.org, you sprinkle a lot of hints in the HTML or in the JSON.
As HTML attributes? Is that still the case?
Attributes, yeah.
Okay.
So you tell them this div, it's describing an event. All the HTML within that div is about an event. And further down, within that div, there's a date. That's the starting date. There's another date, it's this ending date. And given that you're saying this is an event type, this is the starting date, there's no doubt about what it is. If you're not marking it down, if it's just a date within some HTML page, it could be the date of someone's birthday, or it could be the date the post was created, the date, I don't know, an organization was created.
Right.
It's ambiguous. But with this markup, you make it clear what it is.
So it sounds like there's kind of a parallel here, where back when D7 was being developed, while there were all of these various data types available, they were coming from a lot of different places.
Right.
And so Drupal 7 had to pull in namespaces from a lot of different places. But in the past 3 or 4 years, as you said, the search engines caught wind that this was confusing, so they simplified things by moving everything to one place,
to
schema.org. Mm-hmm. And the Drupal community reacted by kind of simplifying its process for getting this markup or this data into D8.
Yeah,
so
kind of.
The search engines simplified things, and therefore we were able to simplify things on our end.
That's one way to look at it. We also improved the markup. So there's that picking the terms and picking the properties from schema.org, that's one thing. But schema.org doesn't force you to use a particular syntax. We had RDFA in Drupal 7 already.
Okay.
So we kept that going in Drupal 8. We improved it. There were several bugs. We cleaned that up. One of the major changes is that fields are now aware of the RDFA. Like before, it was...
Right, and we're going to get into that with the module. That's really exciting stuff.
Yeah. In Drupal 7, it was more like the RDF module was trying to come in on top of the fields without field formatters being aware that there was this RDF thing.
Yeah.
So now they're a bit more aware, and as a result, we are able to produce cleaner markup.
And do some other cool things, which we're going to get to in a second. So how did this whole... I mean, you've been involved with RDF and RDFA in Drupal for a long time. So how did the effort to redo it or update it for D8, how did it get started and who was involved?
Mm-hmm. The first version of RDFA in core was in Drupal 7. And that was maybe around 2012.
Long time ago.
Yeah. So we realized first it was schema.org that just launched. And we realized, this is still relevant. For one, and we need to improve the way we're marking up our pages. So Lynn Clark and myself got together a few years back. We started to change the APIs. Well, first thing was to use CMI, for one, to store the mappings. But really the tipping point was when I started these weekly code sprints to go through all the field formatters, clean up the CMI APIs, and that's when we got started. So we had, I think, about a year... Maybe more than a year ago. I forget when we started this. If Kay and Chris remember.
Yeah, this is where Kay and Chris come in, right?
Yeah.
So real quick, Chris, you're with Redfin Solutions, correct?
Yeah.
And Kay, we've had Kay on the podcast two, three times. I don't even know now. With your awesome Chief Learning Officer title of Own Sourcing.
Yeah. Good to be with you again.
You guys were involved in the code sprints from early on, is that correct?
Fairly early on. I guess I don't know how many you ran before we joined in on them.
We had been working together for a while before we started those weekly habits of getting together and sprinting. So I just want to, when we talk about those sprints, I just want to give a shout out to the regulars that came pretty much every week. So there was Chris and Kay, who are both on the Hangout today, and Jimmy Fallon as well, and Adam Shepard, so they couldn't join today. But they were also very helpful in plowing through the issue queue and getting all the tickets fixed. I actually had to slow down a little bit. I just had a baby last year, so in the last few months I had to slow down, but... For like almost a year, I think we've been meeting every week.
Yeah, and they were really good meetings from a number of different perspectives. For people who wanted really to be able to dig in and get to know it, SCORE was a great resource and always very patient. Was as interested in helping people, get a foothold as in actually seeing the project moved forward quickly. So I was really always curious, Score, how you felt that balance went. If you felt like you were getting as much done on the project through running these weekly sprints as you might have if you'd like said, I'm going to pick a couple of people who can move really quickly and just make sure that the thing moves. You really invited a mix of people.
Yeah. No, I really enjoyed mixing with everyone, even those who were new. I didn't have any problem with onboarding you and Chris and all the gang. So, yeah, I think it was good. I don't think I could have done it on my own anyways. Definitely was useful to have more than just myself.
So, So Kay, when you and Chris first started with the code sprints, this was before Cecchini got involved with Google Summer of Code, so you guys were mainly focused on improvements in actual D8 core. Is that correct?
Right, yeah. That was our...
So what, what Sashini worked on was a UI on top of Core, and what we did during the code sprints was just purely the API that lives in Core. So the field formatters and the way we inject the markup in the HTML when it gets rendered.
All right, just so we have a chance to hear from Chris real quick. So at what point were these APIs, have these APIs been frozen for a while? Were they frozen before Sashini got involved, Chris? Or is that something that's still, well, it's definitely not ongoing anymore, but was that a process that was fairly straightforward?
Yeah, I think, and I came on a little bit even after Kay. In fact, Kay's the one who invited me to join this, and not to take it too far sideways, but this was a great opportunity to learn how to contribute and to contribute to the project in a small group like this. So I really applaud Stefan's motivation to kind of mentor a bunch of people who had no idea what they were doing as far as the project goes. But to answer your question, everything was a moving target if it needed to be at the time that we were doing these sprints. But with that said, we had a really solid foundation when I came on board. You know, I was mostly there to make improvements to what was already largely functional. So even though we weren't at a real API freeze that I know of at the time that Sashini onboarded, things were really solid at that point. Some of the stuff I was working on were performance improvements and things like that. So we really had a great base by the time that happened.
So this was your first involvement with D8 core work, it sounds like?
Absolutely, yeah. I gave a D8 presentation at Drupal Camp New Hampshire, and I guess it sounded like I knew what I was talking about, and so Kay approached me and said we're doing the sprint, and I've been looking for that opportunity to contribute, and this was perfect for me.
Outstanding. So at what point, you know, while all this core work was going on to improve, to map schema.org fields to Drupal fields, at what point did you guys realize, wow, a UI would be really cool, maybe we should, you know, find a Google Summer of Code student? Was that something that you had been thinking of the whole time, or that was just work that was looming and you weren't sure who was going to do it, or what was that process?
Right. So stepping back a little bit, one of the major mistakes that we did in Drupal 7 and that slowed down the adoption of RDF in Drupal 7 was, aside from the numerous namespaces that people had to know about, it was the lack of a UI for mapping your content types and fields to schema.org.
Let me stop you just for a second. So let's say there wasn't a UI. Would this mapping have to be done through configuration?
Through configuration.
Okay.
The same way you'd configure the REST module in core currently, there's no UI. You can do it with YAML.
Okay.
But in Drupal 7, it was actually harder than that because we didn't have YAML. So or CMI, so you'd have to write code to maintain those mappings.
So in your mind, a UI was something that needed to be done. It was just a matter of when and who.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
It came late for Drupal 7, and now I wanted to reverse that situation for Drupal 8 and have it early. So I thought it's a good product for like someone who is beginning to contribute to Drupal, and they can get exposed to all the Drupal 8 APIs.
Yeah.
So I just happened to be traveling in Sri Lanka about a year ago, around Christmas time. So as I do it traditionally, when I go somewhere, I'll look for like groups or people interested in learning about Drupal. Mm-hmm. So I somehow got in touch with Sashini's university. So they offered me a few hours in front of maybe like 100 students or something, and where I presented Drupal and my work with schema.org and all that. And at the end, I said that, you know, the Google Summer of Code coming up this summer. We were in January, so it was, you know, still early enough to get involved. And I told the students, you know, if you're interested in working in this program, just come and see me at the end. So Sashini was one of the students that came. We kept in touch, and then when I got back home, we worked on a proposal that we submitted to the program. It got accepted, so Sashini started to work on the UI, and you know, she made her way all the way through. She passed all the exams.
So let's talk about this for a couple minutes, because this is the meat of all of this, and it's really super interesting. It's the RDF UI module. It's a D8 module. It's not in core, correct?
Right.
And this is a module that allows you, among other things, it allows you to map schemas to content types.
Right. Schema.org types and properties to content types and fields.
Right. So, Suchini, welcome to the podcast. Welcome. You're in Sri Lanka, correct? Uh-oh.
Hi.
There you go. Now we got you. Okay. When you saw Stefan speak at your university, what was it about, you know, D8 or the RDF project or any of it? Like, what attracted you to you know, step up and get involved?
Well, at the time, I haven't even heard about RDF and RDFA, but when Stefan described the concept, it was very interesting, and I definitely wanted to learn more. So that's why I stepped in, I think.
Were you interested in open source in general, or PHP, or content management systems? What about the project?
Well, I'm interested in open source, but I think without JSOC, I wouldn't have contributed this earlier.
So it sounds like you hadn't contributed or been active in any other open source communities?
After I joined Drupal, I also did some minor contributions to schema.org.
Well, yeah. Hopefully you've caught the Drupal bug and will continue to contribute to our community, because from what I've seen, it looks like it's some pretty impressive work.
Yes, I definitely hope to stick around.
I'm very glad that Suchini was here to help us. I was very impressed with her work. Actually, what was even more impressive is I was at a conference in San Francisco over the summer, and that was maybe 2 weeks after the end of the Summer of Code. Suchini said she also contributed to schema.org. The schema.org development process is on GitHub, okay. And there are conversations. It's open, so if you have ideas, if you have new types, or if you have improvements that you want to make to the core of schema.org, you can suggest them. We'll discuss them, and they might get accepted. Right. So Suchini fixed a few of the issues with the core schema, and she actually got her name mentioned during the presentation about schema.org by the guys from Google. So I was very pleased to hear that.
The RDF UI module, why would somebody use it? Well, like, I'm building a website. Let's say I'm building a D8 website. It's going to have a list of events. Do I need the UI module in order to map my event content type?
Right. Currently you do.
Okay.
Because Drupal will not guess what your schema.org mappings are.
Okay.
At least currently today, it won't. It's not capable of doing that.
Okay.
So you need the UI. As you build your content types and new fields, the UI will let you choose a mapping for all of them.
So how does that look? How does that work? There's a great blog post, and there's a link. We'll put a link in the podcast notes. But from a technical standpoint, when someone's building out their content types in D8, like, where does that UI expose itself? Is that a new tab on the content type editing area, or how does that work?
Right. It's a new tab when you go and edit your content type. When you click on Manage Fields, there's a tab in there for the RDF mappings. And then there's a line per field, and you can choose which property from schema.org it applies to.
So I guess your first step is you have to say, okay, well, this content type of mine needs to be mapped to this schema.org.
Right, like event or recipe.
Type,
or
is that the right word? Right. Schema.org type?
Type, correct.
And then once you decide the schema.org type, when you go to your Manage Fields page, for each field of your event content type, you can select which schema.org
property
that content type field should map to.
Exactly. Yeah, and actually, what Suchini did is she made sure that the list of properties that you're offered is only the properties that belong to that type. So after you pick the type, it narrows down the choices.
Yeah, that sounds like a dream, because I remember it in D7, it was a little bit more cumbersome.
It's everything, yeah.
Right. So is that the main part of the RDF UI module, without getting to the builder stuff yet? Because I think the builder stuff is the awesome stuff, so we're going to get to that in a second.
Yeah. I think it's the main part. It's filling the gap when it comes to lack of UI for setting up those mappings.
And that sounds like dead simple easy, which is
right.
Great.
Yeah. And it's essentially kind of what you can do already in Drupal 7. It's already better. Like, what we have in Drupal 8, I think, is better than
simpler.
What we have in Drupal 7.
It's just simpler to set up.
Yeah.
So do these mappings, they come through regardless of the view mode?
Yes. There's nothing that affects, because the view mode is just,
right.
Do you display this or not?
How about if you are pulling in that content type into a view and fields from that content type into view? How does it work with views?
Right. So one of the things that we're lacking still at this point is support for any view type. So if you build a view and if you pull in content, so in other words, like some view mode, it will work.
Right.
But if you build a view based on fields, currently it won't work. And that's just the way Drupal generates a field. It doesn't go through the same rendering pipeline as a view mode.
Right.
So we're lacking that context.
But I think view modes are phenomenal. I think people should use them more. This seems like a good excuse to build your views based on view modes more than fields moving forward.
Right. So if you don't need to build like a table, if you're just building a listing, then you can live with having view modes, then you should use view modes.
Then you get the mapping.
Right.
All right. So as slick as that sounds, the RDF UI builder, is that the right name?
Yeah.
So the builder portion of it, I think, is even cooler. So why don't you talk about that for a minute and explain what that is?
So actually, why don't we let Kevin come in at this point?
So Kevin's role, tell us about Kevin's role real quick. Or Kevin, would you like to talk about what your role was in the project?
Sure. So I got involved working with Stefan around 2 years ago, and we started talking a lot about schema.org and the advantages. I really didn't know anything about RDFA or schema.org at that point, but I got really excited about the advantages from quite a different perspective than I think some people in the linked data community are, which is I saw this as a real potential benefit to site builders to not have to essentially put as much work into creating content strategies and creating content types and all of the attendant sort of field UI work that goes into that, and to have more sort of pre-made, ready-made, smart default kind of content types that they could use out of the box that also had the attendant benefit that they were automatically linked to proper mappings to schema.org, so that they had that sort of smart data layer underneath them sort of just by default. And I actually haven't been involved in the most recent sprint, so I don't know exactly how far the builder has gotten in terms of this sort of the development of it. But in theory, what we really want ultimately is for the user not to have to for them to have to do as little as possible, right? So one of the things with that is to get the smart defaults, right, into all the field mappings. So say, for instance, if I had a field price, right, I should have a smart default of that for the format of decimal, right? Because prices are generally going to be in decimal unless there's some edge case where it's not going to be decimal. So I shouldn't have to set that mapping of or that formatter to decimal when I pull in a price. That should be the automatic default. And then if I want to change it, I should be able to change it. And the beauty of that is that we can get to a stage where sort of people start to share around these mapped content types, with everything already set to smart defaults. And then even a step beyond that, which is a kind of a sort of an ideal future state that I look towards, which is people building what I'd call content packages, where I have a bunch of schema.org mapped content types with all the proper smart default field types in them, and then I also have the entity references. So say, for instance, I had album, song, and then I also had artist, and I also had music event, and all of these have the proper entity references, or the sort of what I would call the generally understood or the most commonly understood entity references for those types. Again, there would be edge cases. Some people might consider an album to be something slightly different in their own content strategy, but there's a generally accepted and understood meaning of album, which is that an album contains a song, and that each song has, is owned by an artist, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So if a user could bring in an entire content package like that as one sort of feature, if you were using features, or whatever that ends up being in Drupal 8, which we aren't really clear on that yet, but or as a CMI package, or some way of bringing this entire package in all in one go, imagine how that facilitates much, much more rapid site building. And again, site building that is then also smart in that everything that you've just built, without you even necessarily as a site builder knowing or being aware of this RDF layer, it is automatically machine readable. That's really the big vision.
So I should say you're coming at this from more of a design and UX background, it sounds like, and I'm also guessing that based on Your title, which I forgot to mention a second ago, you're the Director of Design for the Office of the CTO at Acquia?
That's right.
So did you come to this project mainly looking at it from a UX standpoint, and how can you make this easier, as you said, for end users to actually build not only just build content types, but also link them back to schema.org types?
Right, exactly. So, I mean, the ideal that Dries is, has been pushing for all along with, you know, what he refers to as, you know, the assembled web is building blocks that a site builder can sort of snap together as quickly and easily as possible without having to really understand all of the sort of nitty-gritty of the markup and the code that underlies all of that. And the smarter that we can make that, and the more sane defaults that you can put into that, that again are configurable if you dig in, if you are somebody who wants to sort of go a layer deeper and dig in on remapping things for some edge case that you might have yourself.
Right.
But the smarter that you can make that at the surface, the better, and the more quickly people can put together sites. And so yes, I did definitely come into it from a user perspective, and in this particular instance, it's the site builder persona. Person who's building one or more sites, and they want to be able to do it in a way that is quick and that is also, you know, smart. And, you know, getting to this point in Drupal where you understand not just how to map RDF to particular field types and create these content types, but how to create entity references, you're way down the road of really understanding the inner workings of Drupal when you get to understanding entity references. And if entity references and referenced objects can kind of be there automatically, that vastly simplifies the process for and opens up the whole world of site building to people who are much less technical.
So it's my understanding, and this mainly comes just from the little bit of research I've done over the past 12 hours or 24 hours into the RDF UI module, is the way the builder works is you can actually use the builder to select from one of the hundreds of schema.org types. Is that
right? This is like 400 types and 400 properties.
Right. So you can select which of these schema.org types you want to use and click a few buttons and poof, you have a content type.
Right.
Is that about right?
Yeah.
Maybe
yeah,
not the poof part, but
that's the
but it
that's,
builds content types for you with, as Kevin was saying,
exactly.
Smart defaults that are mapped to schema.org
exactly.
types. That's phenomenal.
Yeah, you just select the type, you select the fields you want to also create from schema.
Well, yeah, you select the type, then schema, then the module says, here are all the fields available
from schema.org.
You pick the ones you actually want to use.
Yes, and then you say which field type you want to use for that field,
and
like
if it's date
or text.
Right, as Kevin was saying, it gives you the smart defaults.
Right, it tries to. Still have some work to improve that, but you know, okay. We've got some proof of concept.
How can it not be? It's not complete yet? What's up with that?
Sachini has been pretty good at keeping up with the work, even after the Summer of Code project,
yeah.
Which I'm very impressed.
And no, this sounds like, I mean, an amazing thing. I mean, I was looking at the, again, the link will be in the notes, but there's a little screencast that somebody else put together, you were saying, was just someone who...
That's the blog post? You mean the Canvas.net?
Yes.
Because Sachini put together a screencast.
Oh, is that this screencast, the one that's in the blog post, or is this the one that the author of the blog post did?
I think it's Sachini's.
Okay, all right.
Screencast.
Well, regardless, there's a screencast there that kind of demos some of this stuff, and for me, that's kind of like the whiz bang feature, is because now if you want to, you know, as Kevin was saying, this is kind of a shortcut. You know, if you know that you're building a site where you know maybe it's going to be a you know, like an IMDb competitor, rather than building out your movie content type yourself, use the RDF UI builder, you know, grab the schema.org movie type, hit a couple buttons, select the fields you want to use, and boom, you've got a content type with everything already mapped.
I mean, the bonus with that is if you go down that route of creating content type from schema.org, you already know what fields search engines will be looking for.
Right.
So you kind of you're not going to miss anything
right.
big that they're after.
That's awesome.
So it's a different way of thinking about content building. So I think
it's a standards way of thinking. Rather than every content type being, and I'm using air quotes here, custom.
Right.
You're going to a source, a source that will help the business, you know, with their SEO.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And using that as your starting point.
Yeah. So I just checked, and this this screencast is actually another screencast. It's the author of this blog post created his own screencast, so that's pretty amazing.
Yeah. All right, so what's next? Where do we go? As you said, you know, nothing's complete yet, but you know it's well on its way. So between now and the time the D8 is released, what are the? Is it just polishing and fixing bugs and finishing mappings, or is there other big chunks which you're hoping to get
done? I think
done?
We need to look at the UX pretty seriously, and I know I just haven't had the time to in the last few months to sit down with Kevin and others to do that, but we definitely want to do that before the release of Drupal 8, which is sometime, I guess, later this year.
I definitely need to get into the module and do another usability review of what has been built so far, and that will certainly produce a list of tasks that we can start to work on in terms of improving usability. But then additionally, there's this other layer, you know, that I referred to before, which is I don't think necessarily part of this module. It may be another helper module or an additional module sort of on top of, you know, the work that we've already done, which adds this capability of creating another meta level, which is not just the content type, but the content package. In other words, several content types and their entity references. And when we can get to that level of the content package, that's when I think that it's really revolutionary.
So what you're talking about here is really the first use case that Features was supposedly designed for.
Essentially, yes. Yeah.
Not the way it's used right now, because it's more like a CMI stopgap, but it's going back to the true roots of Features.
So let me ask a question. It might be a little bit of a rabbit hole, but when you're talking about these packages of content or content type packages, and they're linked with in Drupal entity reference fields, is there an analog to these references in schema.org types? Like, can you have one schema.org type that refers to another one? Is there a mechanic?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just another property. Properties in schema.org can link to another type. It can be a string if it's like a title or the first name of a person.
Okay.
But it can also be another type. So, for example, for events, it could be a list of attendees.
So that's something that exists with schema.org. It's just a matter of us, you know,
incorporating.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely, yeah.
All right, cool. So
actually, before you move on from that, isn't it fair to say that actually probably some of the biggest potential for RDF actually comes through what you're describing right there, and that once you start imagining how those links work and how we basically create a knowledge graph from it, that things really start to explode?
Yeah, absolutely. You're on point. Okay, this is the goal of linked data, linking all the entities from the web to each other and making meaningful links among themselves. So whether it's linking entities from your site or linking from your site to other entities outside your site, somewhere else on the web, and turning the web into this giant database or knowledge graph. This is what Google has been trying to do internally, collecting all the data that it can find online. It's got data about more than 500 million entities or things, like places and people, mm-hmm. and it's got about 18 billion relationships between those entities. So this is what powers rich snippets, those improved search results that you see when you do a search. So if you do a search for like Brian House, for example, on Google, even on my phone on Google now, you will see the job title.
Right. It just doesn't pull in a list of pages where that string is.
Right. It tells you the answer.
It displays information about Brian specific.
Right. It just pulls that data from the page itself and presents it to you right on the search results. So.
And it's cool enough that Google can do that, but actually having RDF in Drupal puts this in the hands of, now, especially with the Builder UI, it puts it in the hands of site builders. Now we can actually use relationships so that we have a powerful extra bit of information that can be changed and queried on the fly that we can display. I mean, to me, that's like the killer app for the web almost.
Right. I feel like we've kind of come full circle in the conversation. We started with an overview. We kind of dove down into, you know, what we're getting, what we're doing in D8, and now we're coming back out and kind of recapping.
Yeah.
Were there any other little bits that we failed to cover here? I feel like for me, coming from a standpoint of knowing very little about what was going on with D8 and RDF and RDFA, I have a pretty good understanding now and actually very excited to check out this module.
Right. So we haven't talked much about the benefits. I mean, there's the rich snippets, right? SEO.
Right.
Search engine optimization. And I also would like to read SEO as search experience optimization, where we have apps like Google Now or any kind of notification that you get from Google. So this is not about search. You're not searching for anything. It's Google reminding you of something that you might have forgotten or that you don't know about. This is another area where schema.org can be also very helpful. Google can gather data and put data together that you might not have thought of doing or searching.
Through the relationships that Kay and you have, you know, were just talking about.
And so that's why I think incorporating schema.org in your site is important, not just for SEO, but just in general for the web and for enabling all sorts of applications to happen.
So it seems like this has kind of been a I don't call it a pet project, but an area of interest for Dries for a few years at least.
Right.
I could recall a DrupalCon probably as D7 was just getting started.
Yeah, that was in Boston, right?
I have a terrible memory for that.
It was in Boston.
But where he talked about this.
Yeah.
So has he seen the RDF UI stuff? And I mean,
I don't believe so, no. I've been waiting for it to be a bit more mature before showing it to him. But
this really feels like, thinking back to that keynote, this really feels like the D7 stuff was, you know, was in the right direction and it was possible. But this really feels like, you know, we've achieved a good part of that vision.
Yeah.
Here,
yeah.
With what we've talked about and what's coming.
Right. And the work is being done under the RDF UI namespace on Drupal.org. There's some issues still open. Like, we need to clean up the UI. We need to use a better library for the dropdown. We want to use Select2, which is actually hopefully will land in core.
Mm-hmm.
There's some conversation about that right now. But other than that, I think, you know, this is the workflow we're after. It's not there yet, and we have to work out the kinks. But
it seems like the foundation is laid. It's just a matter of putting, as Kevin was saying, a very usable UI on top.
Yeah.
So, Kate, you mentioned earlier about the code sprints and how you and Chris got involved in code sprints to help out in this project. So let's kind of wrap up this conversation by asking, if somebody wants to get involved and help you guys out with testing or developing or whatever, what's the best way to not only get in touch with you guys, but you said you have weekly sprints. When do those take place?
Right,
do those take place?
So there's two things. There's two products. There's Core, Drupal Core, the APIs, purely the APIs for RDF. And then there's the RDF UI module in Contrib. And that's a separate project, and somehow it's been separate teams, kind of.
Okay.
There wasn't much overlap, but I'm sure there will be more overlap going forward. So we're not doing the weekly code sprints at the moment. We cannot stop after the summer, just because I got busier and I had more commitments with family.
You got family.
But I'm hoping to start again in a few weeks when things settle down. But by all means, the issue queue is there all the time, 24/7. Okay. We have open issues.
Were you guys on IRC? Are you generally in Pound Drupal Contribute, or is it Pound Drupal RDF or anything like that?
We're on both, actually. Yeah.
Okay.
We have a Drupal-RDF channel as well.
And are you Score SCOR everywhere?
Yep.
Right. And Kay, what's your IRC handle?
It's K_V, so KAY_V.
All right. And Chris?
I'm in IRC as SCEO. I say CO. Some people say other weird things. D Wells is far too common for me to have snagged it on IRC.
And are you guys generally active? I know that there's a global sprint that just happened. But are you guys generally active in sprints and at camps and things like that?
Yeah, I was actually, I wanted to mention the last Drupal camp I went to was Drupal Camp Asheville.
Right.
Over the summer. And so there was a code sprint there. I also did a presentation on schema.org and Drupal 7. So
we'll have those links in the show notes.
There's a video of my presentation. That's kind of the latest state of the art. So if you want to watch that, follow the link.
All right. Fantastic. All right. Well, I can't thank you guys enough for taking the time this morning. It's a rare early morning podcast interview here for joining us. I mean, this stuff sounds great. I can't wait to check out that UI module and play around with it. But thank you very much for all of your hard work and your effort, and Sacchini especially. Thanks for all your hard work over the summer and for sticking with it, even though it's clearly not the summer anymore.
Well, it's been very interesting contributing to Drupal, and especially learning about RDF UI, RDF and RDFA. So I should thank Stefan for all the help. He played a very major role in it. Yes, there are a few people contributing to the module already, so it's nice to see.
Thanks again, everybody, for joining us, and we look forward to following the progress in the future.
All right.
Well, thanks for the invitation.
Thank you, guys.
All right, so now just for a quick bit of Drupal Easy News, our live online Drupal career training program continues. We graduated our first online class late. We have our second online session starting up on March 10th. This is a live online class taught by myself and other instructors. You get screencasts, you get PDFs, you get professional Drupal instruction for 12 weeks. We meet 3 half-days a week. This will be an evening class, so these classes will take place in the evening here East Coast time. There's all kinds of information about this on the Drupal Easy website. As always, it will be a link in the show notes, so I encourage you to check it out if you're interested in long-form professional Drupal training. All right, Ryan, I think we've got some news to talk about.
Yes, indeed. This one is actually a fairly quick story that is, and if you ask me, a fairly big change. In Drupal 8, we now have views in core, which hopefully everybody knows that by now. Hooray for that. But then there's a little change record here that says Vue's rewrite functionality now uses Twig. So if you think about it, if you've ever been in the Vue's interface and you click on that little thing that says rewrite output or the no results sort of section, you were able to put in these little tokens with like a square bracket, and maybe you put the node ID in there or contents from some field or the number of records that you're pointing out or whatever it happens to be. Now, instead of square bracket, it's going to be 2 curly brackets. But ostensibly, you could do other Twig things in there, I would assume, like repeating and, you know, little simple logic if statements and that kind of stuff. Which, now that I think about it, this is fresh information for me. But now I'm saying it out loud, this is actually a really good thing because, you know, in Drupal 5, you pretty much had to use the PHP filter with Vue's because there were lots of things that it didn't really do and nobody really knew how to write Vue's plugins. And that's improved greatly. You know, now there's a Vue's plugin for almost everything. But when I think about it, we really want to be able to do those little bits of logic in a Vue because that's the most, it's sort of like the smartest place to do it. Some people, I think, would argue you would do it in a template file, and maybe Ted, you would chime in here and say, you know,
yeah, it sounds interesting. I mean, it's definitely better than putting PHP in there.
That's for sure.
I mean, one thing that I was sort of surprised when I saw this, and I haven't had time to investigate it more, is, you know, why only in Vue's? And I haven't played around enough with Drupal 8 to to know all the token enhancements.
Yeah,
but it kind of seems weird to have like one way to rewrite or to sub in information in Vue's versus I'm trying to think of other places you would use tokens in Drupal 8, but there's other places it seems like, and maybe this is only contrib modules in Drupal 7 where you would sub in a token. I'm like blanking on a example right there.
Well, I just think as an input format, you know, that lives inside of content, that it could be really interesting, you know. Sometimes, I mean, I guess there's a whole, argument between, like, do you do something in code or do you do it in content? You know, like, one of the problems of putting PHP code inside of a node is now you have to go find all the places where you ever did that, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's definitely, you know, an issue that's raised if you do too much of this in different parts of your site, in different interfaces, in different modules. But the other one is sort of that You know, Twig is supposed to be easy enough for non-programmers to be able to do simple things in.
I thought there was going to be something like in Drupal 8 where you have inside of like a text area field where you could use a token from something else in that node. So, you know, insert the value of that field here. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but if, you know, if there is, then...
Yeah, I think, you know, in WordPress they call that snippets, but I believe I have seen some people talking about doing that in content, you know, in input filter area, so...
So would that be with Twig, or would that be with the other token system?
I think this story only raises more questions. Maybe we'll have to get somebody on who works on this on a more little bit more daily basis, because I'll have to say that all I know about it is something that I've seen on a video or read on a change log like this one at this point.
Yes.
But well, Mike is tweeting something at us. In Path Auto, apparently, what? I would hope you would be using tokens.
You would
for
use,
that.
Yeah, that seems like you would not want to use Twig there, because Twig is really like, that's not for output. Like, Path Auto is for, you know, this is a setting that's going to create a URL. And that doesn't seem like something where, you know, that's not templating. Whereas I could see like the rewrite of a field is kind of like templating, so you'd want to use something like Twig there.
Yeah, and I mean, I wouldn't want to be able to like repeat text and like, you know, do logic inside of like, you know, a title of a node. Like, let's say we had automatic node titles, or I think the Drupal 7 version of it is called entity labels.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't want to have Twig there. I guess it would be nice if the syntax was a little bit more consistent, right? Double curly brace versus square bracket with the colon separation. The colon separation, isn't it dots in Twig? Like, I think that would start to get confusing if you had two different syntaxes, but you could use them in very similar places.
Yeah, but if they were exactly the same, then you wouldn't be clear, you know, as which one you were using.
That's true.
Yeah, and the other example is our silent partner points out is the email template. So if use it, you know, if like you're an admin's creating an account, would you use the regular tokens or would you use Twig there? And I'm assuming that you would use the regular tokens.
Yeah, I was going to say, if it's going to go out to a user, that sort of thing, that, you know, if you could accidentally put, you know, the... some sort of sensitive information that would be available in a token that you would want to get scrubbed, I'd rather have that be through token there, because it's going to get sent to common users than, I don't know why. It would make me nervous to have that be a templating language versus just token replacement.
Sounds like it's time to learn more about Drupal 8 to actually dig in and start testing some of this out. Though, yeah. Obviously, I guess if you're dealing with Drupal, the last beta, none of this would not be available anyways.
That's for sure. So we do have some more stories. I have to say, I haven't actually read the other ones too deeply. Ted, do you have any?
I have read the other two.
Okay, well, do you want to talk about the next one on our list, which is by a man with a very fine beard?
Okay, so this is yours is retrospective of 2014 and then sort of looking forward to 2015. This is a blog post that he put out. So, you know, it starts with beta 1 being released back in 2014 and sort of lists a bunch of big features that made it into Drupal 8, like responsive design, HTML5 support, and a bunch of others, like what you see is what you get, in-place editing, and then goes on to sort of just give the high points as far as, you know, there are now 2,500 contributors, and it was interesting, like the 2,500th contributor was a high school student from, I was going to say Sri Lanka, but that's what Mike was talking about. I'm not sure where this high school student was, but that student was participating in the Google Code 2014. And then talks about the sprints and then different ways that, you know, we're looking into This student is from Indonesia.
So the main point here is that Dries has sort of written this like play by play of all the cool stuff that has happened in the last year with Drupal, just Drupal in general, but mostly Drupal 8.
Pretty lots
much of new
all
milestones.
Drupal 8 for 2014.
Sort of like the year in review.
Yeah. And then looking forward to 2015 as far as improving Drupal 8 and how it's going to be different with the new release cycle, and also trying to get other organizations to contribute to Drupal. And I think it's a big push in 2015 is going to be, you know, how do we make it sustainable? And there's been a lot of talk about that this year as far as, you know, do we change how to make Drupal development sustainable? And they were, I think in Austin, he mentioned the idea of sponsored development with, was it ads on Drupal.org?
Well, yeah, that there would be a lot of possible, rewards, I guess, you know, for employing core contributors or funding, you know, core development. You know, like currently you can give money to the Drupal Association, but their hands are somewhat tied about being able to, you know, sponsor development in core because they're supposed to be impartial. So a company, on the other hand, you know, and we know of some companies are doing this now. The company I work for, Blink Reaction, we have one full-time Drupal core contributor. And a lot of people work on, you know, Drupal core stuff and contrib projects. That if that company has something that they need, which actually this works really well in open source land, right? A lot of our clients all have this same problem. Let's try to solve that problem, but instead of solving it just for ourselves, let's solve it for everyone, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Acquia has developed their program that is the large scale Drupal initiative. That's sort of like the consortium of people that work on the mega humongous websites or mega humongous number of websites. You know, there's one company and they've got, you know, 300, 500, thousands of Drupal websites all running on this like common platform. And there's certain problems you have when you start doing that, that you don't necessarily have when you're just running one site.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting. I feel like there's been a lot of talk about different ways, and a lot of people this year tried GitTip, which I haven't heard much about lately, but I just feel like there was a bunch of different ways that people tried to fund development. There was the developer who was working on the flag version, the Drupal 8 version of the flag module. She did a Drupal Fund Us campaign to get her to Austin to work on that. And there was the GitTip. And so it'll be interesting to see what pans out as, you know, big companies working on Socket Winch was the developer who was working on Flag. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of, which funding models work in the future, or, you know, does it go back, is it mostly large companies employing full-time developers to work on core, or the whole, I guess sprints is another way he mentioned in the blog post, but also, you know, companies also can sponsor sprints to move Drupal 8 forward.
Yeah. So one more story that we want to bring up is this a guy that I have met at DrupalCons before, Oliver Seldman, and he talks about some of just the awesome new things that you can do with views, especially just the fact that, hey, views is in Drupal core now, so we've had a couple stories about that in the last couple months. But there are sort of like new display types or like reworked display types that you can do with views now. And I know, Ted, you were trying to tell us something about views displays in our last episode that was just going right over my head.
I think he mainly talks here about three, and we have the embed, which a lot of people already sort of use different views displays as a, you know, I want to just embed this via code somewhere. And it gives you a lot of flexibility if you're writing custom code to not have to, you know, make some complex list. You can sort of hand that off to views and just bring it back and maybe just use your custom code to decide when it's displayed. So I think that's pretty interesting. Also like it because the idea that, you know, you're going to, if you're going to reference a view in code and then you're going to export your view into code, that it would be easy to sort of search, okay, which views have I exported as embedded, you know, as the embed display type.
All right, Ted, can we take a sidebar for just 1 minute?
Yeah.
So in Drupal 7, we got this functionality, entity field query. And there seems to be somewhat of a divide between people who like using entity field query or people who are very happy to just use a view to sort of pull out a query. Like, A, where do you stand on that?
I mean, I use entity field query mostly for logic. Like, I'm doing some sort of business logic and I need to, you know, grab a certain some nodes that have certain field values and they are a certain content type. So I use it more for that kind of stuff where I maybe need to act on those nodes rather than I need to display them back
like,
to the user.
I need to process a whole bunch of things that have these criteria. So I'm going to use entity field query to load them up because it's way easier than writing an SQL query, but it's not as much work as writing, creating a view and then having to go into my code and reference that view by name and do some other kind of crazy thing. It all just happens right there in the code.
Yeah, and also if I wanted to just, okay, I need to display three teasers or three nodes as teasers here, you know, in some custom code, I might actually do that with entity field query than just calling entity view. But if I was going to do something where, okay, I need to make, you know, display some nodes here, but I also need some information displayed that is from a node that's being used as any reference or display some information that's on a term on a node, then I think, you know, views is nice for doing that because you have the whole pull in relationships and stuff like that, which you could do in custom code, is just a little bit harder.
Yeah.
So I don't actually find myself using views embed that much, but when I need it, it's really convenient.
Well, and that's why I brought this up, is because views embed, I could see somebody going, oh, well, why would you use views embed if you have entity field query? And especially since I think entity field query has supposedly gotten more powerful in Drupal 8 now.
Yeah. But the other thing is on this article, what I've noticed just in the graphic here is you can duplicate a display as another type of display. So now you can usually say, okay, I have a block view that I've made, a block display. I can clone that block, but the new display is also going to be a block.
It's all I've ever wanted out of life, Ted. I'm not even kidding. It's there's so many times when you get up to a certain point and this thing's overridden in just a little bit of a way, or it has this one extra field, and now you're like stuck copying and pasting things over from one thing to another. Mike is supporting that statement.
I feel like one of us should be like, saying what
we should
Mike's
read
saying.
What Mike in is his, saying yeah, in like our in best voice. Manello voice.
I wish I had worked on impression beforehand, but I didn't. So that would be like, oh, I have you know multiple pages that I set up, but I want to make a block that's similar to one of these pages. I can duplicate this page as a block.
If only you guys could read what Mike was typing.
We should, So we'll probably put a robot voice in later reading Mike's text. and then you have the entity reference display, which obviously since that was already in the entity reference module, but now that entity reference is in core, that's one of the built-in displays. And then there's also this REST export. If you have the RESTful web services enabled, so you can make a view that's going to export JSON or XML. So that would be a really easy way to make an endpoint for another service to call out to your Drupal site to get some information. So I think that would be sort of like Vue's Data Export Now does that with JSON and XML, so maybe that'll be something similar to that. Though there may be more logic around creating the endpoint in this type of display than there is now.
So, Ted, do you think that people named Jason are just angry every time that someone starts talking about JavaScript, and then they go, "What? What did you say?" Like, they have to just start tuning things out when they're at work.
But the people named JSON probably are even more have a problem.
Or someone who is Jay's son.
Yeah, yeah. Man.
For all the Jays who are fathers out there, we salute you.
Or the people who have, you know, Xavier Michael Lanier, the XML initials. That's got to be a pain.
Yes, indeed. Mike, turn on your mic.
I often have a problem when people are, you know, talk. I often think people are talking about me talking. But they're just talking about TED Talks.
TED Talks. It's terrible. Ted, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Have you used the webenabled.com before?
I've used it many times. I've used their current, I think, which is their current, and I've also used the 2.0 version, which sort of takes it a step further. But yeah, I've used their development all the time for setting up new development environments. You get your Git repository, you get your easy to add people to projects, easy to. One thing I've used for training purposes is, how does this work? You can give somebody a link to duplicate one of your environments.
Yeah, you set up a site and then. Just like you would do with like a Google Doc or something, you give them a link, and when they click on the link, it will like make a copy of this site and copy it into their account.
Yeah. So you can just be working on something with a client, and you know, if they're also maybe a developer, but you're sort of consulting with them, and it's like, okay, here's a link to just, you know, mess around with what we've been working on, and they don't have to worry about, oh, I'm going to mess up the, you know, the project that we've been working on. You can just sort of start. Use this as sort of a sandbox right off our real project.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, one of the things I love about Web-Enabled is, have you ever gotten the phone call, and I'm sure you have, that's like, hi, we're such and such a small business X or nonprofit Y, and we have an existing website, but we want to use something that lets us update it ourselves. We're looking at Drupal, and I say, okay, well, who are you hosted with? And they say, oh, big box web hosting company. And I go, oh, okay, well, one of these days we'll have to get you off of that web hosting company. But in the meantime, let me just set up a quick sandbox for you in Web-Enabled. Clickety, clickety, clack. And now you've got one. So, you know, that only takes a few minutes. And I think that this is just a really great enabling platform for people. And they have a 30-day free trial. And you can set up a Drupal website, and you can also do really fun things like install Drupal 8 and install Open Atrium and install, you know, the Commerce Kickstart profile with just one click. So do go check out our friends at webenabled.com and check out the Web-Enabled 2.0 beta at my.webenabled.com. All right.
You guys,
that's the ad portion of the week. Mike, you're back.
This is, well, we're going to try it. Because it's smoothed out on my end.
You want to do your pick of the week before you lose us?
Absolutely. So the first one I want to mention is the simple hierarchical select module. Now, I'm going to go a little bit backwards this week because I actually haven't used this module yet, but I have.
Screenshot.
I wanted to bring it up because I've used a hierarchical select module for years. But it's getting a little long in the tooth, I think, because there's certain things that don't work. You need a certain version of jQuery update with it. It doesn't seem like it's been maintained as well as it could be. I had no idea this module existed, the simple hierarchical select. It's got thousands of users. So I guess my first question is, have either of you guys used this instead of hierarchical select for anything?
I have. I don't actually remember whether I kept it or I went back to hierarchical select. Hierarchical select, yeah, is really complex. And it's got a lot going on and tries to do a lot. I think that's the thing that I was trying. I was just getting tired of the complexity of it and went for this module. But I can't remember if I ended up using it project.
I just ran across it today, so I figured I would I'd throw it up there and just see.
I believe I have seen it, and it was just like Ted said, it was too simple for what I needed it for.
Oh no, I was saying that was what I liked about it, was that hierarchical select is too complex.
I think it must have been missing one thing that I needed. Yeah. Or some feature that I was expecting to have, and I ended up going with regular old hierarchical select. We're losing Mike, so we will get Mike's second pick in just a minute. But for now, Ted, would you like to go ahead and tell us about your pick of the week?
I feel like I don't, because you at least I don't know if Mike's going to get a chance to, because this Mike, because of his connection. But I feel like you're going to harp on me for the selection.
Okay. I'll go gentle on you, Ted.
Okay, I picked the Lingit module. So I think I had first seen this module in the 2.0 version of OpenAtrium, and it basically, where I've used it is in a text area that was using what you see is what you get, and it creates a link field, but instead of just having the, put in the URL, it gives you the ability to search content. So you would search for a node and it would automatically make the URL to that node, or you could also enter a link URL to an external site. And for the client that I was working with, they wanted to link to other articles, or this was, I think it was an intranet site, wanted to link to other issues. And so they didn't obviously know the node ID, or they couldn't be sure about the alias, so they could just type in and it would automatically give them it. So it worked well for me. I've heard just very recently that other people have had a lot of problems with it. Such as?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is included in Panoply, for example. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And I think we've mentioned Panoply a couple times, where there are things Panoply does, or the way that they configure things, that they would be helpful if you weren't me and knew mm-hmm. how these things worked underneath. And then when I try to make a change to something, it just doesn't do what I want it to. And then I wag my fingers in the air for a while and try to figure out what the heck is going on. That was a very long way of saying I'm sure that this is useful for non-technical people.
Lingit. Yeah, I mean, I guess in the site that I had it on was not too complex, and we didn't have media installed. So it may be a question of, the particular editor that we were using, CK editor. And it was, it's just working well. And it's, I especially like the search ability, but it also gives you the ability to easily to add like classes to a link. If we weren't using that, but you could add that. But it's a way, because a lot of people, when they're writing an article or a blog post, they don't think, oh, I'm linking to another node. I'm going to link to this other thing I made on the site, which was the title, and that's what they remember is the title. Mm-hmm. And also it'll also make the link directly to the system path versus the alias, which is useful.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, I think the problem for why this module exists is very clear. And I think there are maybe a few solutions to it, but this one it's very robust. I mean, it does a lot. There is a mm-hmm. lot of things in your Swiss Army knife just with this one module.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Ryan, do you have a pick?
Yes. I was going to pick this last week, and then I got things thrown at my head because I picked three picks. So this is my fallback pick from last week.
All right.
It is called Fallback Formatter, and it was written by our good friend and drinking buddy, Dave Reed. So this is the point in the show where you have to take a shot because we mentioned one of Dave's modules. This is actually something that certain modules already include this, but this is like a general solution for it. So one of the examples I have is I wrote a module that we talked about on the podcast a little while ago that lets you format a date in a certain way, but then also link that date to a particular view that contains that date, right? And in order to do that, you really need two formatters. The first one is the thing to let you link, and the second one is the fallback formatter, which has to duplicate all the functionality of the date formatter in order to get its job done.
What?
But you do some stuff. You reuse code as much as you can there. But it ends up that can be useful sometimes in another situation. Let's say that in the example of views, right, you also have the views thing with the no results. Sometimes you have a thing, but then you want to spit out a different thing if that first thing is empty. So let's say you upload an image and you want to have a default image as a fallback, right? Or you have a link to something, and if there is no link, maybe you just want to put out the words no link. You could do a lot of different things with a fallback formatter.
So can you use this just in the manage display tab?
Yes, that is exactly what it is.
And is it, so the fallback idea, is that always the field is empty?
In the project description, it literally says the first thing that returns an output wins. Oh. So okay. I believe what you're kind of doing is you're setting up like a stack of different solutions. And if one of them returns good output, then that will get displayed and it won't try to do any of the other ones. Very similar to like in Drupal, you can override a template or a theme function. Mm-hmm. And the one that's sort of like the most important is the one that's going to be the output, right?
So I see this as a work in progress, or that's what are you? So, but there's the GitHub development branch. Is that where you're using the latest one from GitHub?
I'm going to go ahead and say this is actually untested on my part, but I think that this is an important project. And if this is a problem that you have where you want to have two formatters, and you don't want to sit down and write some custom PHP code for it, you know which two formatters you want, either this one or that one. Then do check this out.
All right.
So that's my pick for the week. And we do want to go ahead and do some plugs for upcoming events. Unless, Mike, you are feeling good and confident about your pick of the week.
I'm here. I can, I don't want to, make the podcast difficult for people to listen to.
So far, so good.
Okay. So I'll just say it's the Block font. It's really useful for demos and prototypes. You can basically put real text in, like lorem ipsum text, but then just display it using this font. So it looks like it's got, it turns it in each character into a block. So it looks like, sentences and words and not just solid lines. Really, really cool. Really handy for demos where you don't want your audience to be distracted by the words, but still get the gist of the cadence of the page.
So you don't want your client to say, wasn't this site supposed to be in English?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it just removes one more distraction.
I like it.
Okay.
Well, and if you've ever used a layout program like PageMaker, or I guess Quark would be another one, as you zoom out from the page, the graphics program will actually replace the text with a font that looks exactly like this. So for people who are used to desktop publishing, this should make a lot of sense.
I like it.
Very cool.
Yeah. And by the way, I just want to mention, while I was muted, it's the best podcast ever.
Well, we'll just cut out the section where you were just on. No, we miss you.
Mike, come back to us. When is your exile to Boston finished? Oh, he's off, he's not going to answer. Poor Mike.
Yeah. I'm here now. This is our last week of AquaEU. So This is a big week for the students. We're working on their final project. They're taking the AquaEU certification exam on Friday, just as a benchmark.
Mm.
We don't expect any of them to pass. I don't think maybe one or two will pass. Those who have used Drupal, previous to the class, but we want to benchmark them now, and then have them take it, 6, 9, 12 months from now, and see how much the experience of working at AquaEU really, really improves their score.
And Mike, did you say they took one at the beginning of class?
No. They're taking one, this Friday, and then they're going to take them again. Okay.
So the control is at the end of class.
Right.
It's like science. That's my brain is going to.
Right. Well, you know what it is? It's because the test was never meant to be passable just by taking a class.
Yeah.
Right.
The test is really meant to be passable with knowledge and experience. So that's why the control is at the end of the classroom. And then we'll see how much the experience adds to their score.
Well, and speaking of classes, not that we owe anyone a plug, but if you are interested in taking the certification exam and you're nervous about it, I do know that there are some classes being offered, you know, in-person classes that you can take that will teach you some of the things you need to know that pass the test. So you could look those up. But we have some events coming up. If you are looking to learn more about Drupal, meet some Drupal people, get involved in the Drupal community, attend a Drupal 8 code sprint, do check out Drupal Camp New Jersey, January 30th through February 1st. And I believe during which the whole entire time at Princeton University in northern New Jersey, there will be Drupal 8 code sprinting happening. In addition to some really neat events, Ted, you are going to be offering a Drupal training. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, so it's Drupal 8 module development. So it's like just very beginning learning to make a simple practical module in Drupal 8. So there's still spaces if you're interested. It would be helpful, you know, you don't need to know Drupal 7 module development, but if you do know Drupal 7 module development, it would kind of be useful to see, okay, this is how it was done in Drupal 7, this is how it's done in Drupal 8. And the version of the module that we're making, you know, there is a Drupal 7 version of the module, so you can kind of see what the difference is. There's actually a Drupal 5 and 6 of the version of the module also. Yeah, so it's sort of starting your self out on Drupal 8 development, and we'll be working off the current beta of Drupal 8. So yeah, you can go to drupalcampnj.org to sign up. I'm also going to be doing a session on just sort of little custom code bits, and so that should be interesting.
Very cool. Yeah, and to the best of my knowledge, I will be going, although I haven't actually planned my travel yet at this point, so we got to work on that. And then this is a teaser. We are going to say, please, if you are interested in attending Drupal Camp in Florida, in Orlando, from April 11th to 12th, then we have a little sign-up page where you can go give us your email address, and we'll let you know more information about the camp as it develops. We are working hard behind the scenes here. The website committee is working on things. People that do the catering, organizing the sessions, lots of work goes into every single Drupal camp. As soon as we have something to announce, we will announce it on that email list, and you can go give us your email address right now for Drupal Camp Florida. We do want to say thank you to all the people who were on our interview at the beginning of the podcast, Stefan, Sacchini, Kevin, and Kay. Of course, to Mr. Mike Anello, Altamike on the Twitter. You can find him. And check out DrupalEasy.com for upcoming training classes. You can follow us, the Drupal Easy training and podcast at Drupal Easy on Twitter, on Facebook. Check out our podcast on iTunes Store or the Miro podcast directory or your favorite podcast directory, including Stitcher. Ted, how do we find you on the internet?
SixMileTech.com or Ted Bow on Twitter or SixMileTech on Twitter.
Very nice. And I am Liberator, take out the last vowel. And do check out the feed for the Bringing Art and Technology Together podcast, which is BATTideas.com. We'll be putting up an episode from the Orlando video game conference, Otronicon, this week, which actually has a really inspirational story about kids who learn how to write code. And specifically, there's one young girl who is vision impaired, and she created this sort of radio drama, but she wrote code to script all of the audio actions, and you will get to hear that little radio play that she created. So do go check out batideas.com for that podcast from me. And thanks for listening to the Drupal Easy podcast. Any parting comments from you, Mr. Ted?
No. Well, looking forward to Mike leaving Boston, I guess, only for the mic purpose, for having him on the podcast.
and Mike, I'll pretend to be you for just a second and say, see ya! That's my best Mike and Ella impression.
That wasn't bad.
Okay.
A little too long. Tighten it up next time.
Sorry. The more like, see ya!
There you go, better. Much better. come to All right. Play. Yeah.
All right.
That was excruciating.
Poor Mike.
What do you think?
It got so bad. Like it would go like 5 or 10 seconds. I didn't hear anything. Then I'd hear a word that would go away again. And I just. But no, you guys are great. From what I heard, it was hysterical.
The running commentary was beautiful.
Dude, my favorite part, I was laughing out loud during the Xavier, Jason, Michael comment or whatever. That was genius.